Friends, I'm excited about the future of Ontario, but it's up to each of us to roll up our sleeves and get it done. We're the only party with a plan to cut through the excuses. We're the only party saying yes.
I'm sure this is not the most fun thing you'll ever do on a Monday night, but because you're joining us, it shows that that you care and that this election has a lot at stake.
It is now or never to address the climate crisis. And that's why we need to stop Mr. Ford from paving over our future. We need affordable homes, not expensive highways that will primarily benefit a few wealthy land speculators and make life more expensive for the rest of us.
The past 4 years have been really, really tough. And while I know Ontarians are strong and resilient, so many are still suffering in this province. You think about students forced to learn through screens, being isolated from their friends, seniors who are so concerned about ending up in for-profit long-term care, and the cost of everything going up for virtually everybody.
This week, we are talking exclusively, a little bit of a shorter show right now, but we're talking exclusively on the debate that happened here in Ontario.
Quick debate hit. Post-debate analysis.
So I'm wondering, Christo, who are the human beings, normal, regular, non-crazy people, that are watching this for an hour and a half? Like, I don't know, man.
A decent chunk of Canadians watch some or all of the federal debates. My assumption is that maybe provincial is a little bit less watched, but I mean, I think timing is a real issue.
Yeah.
Like, unless I'm mistaken, this debate and the Northern debate last week are the only debates. There was a couple pre-writ where Ford chose not to attend. I think there was a debate on women's issues. I believe it was televised or live streamed, but I believe it was just Schreiner, Del Duca, and Horwath who kind of went to these things. And I mean, in essence, the timing's really bad. So one factor above all is that, people might see clips on the internet. Clips were probably played on, the nightly news, like the local Global and CTV, CBC broadcasts, across the province. But the Northern debate was like on a weekday afternoon. It was like a Tuesday afternoon. Like, most people weren't able to watch that. And most people, most people, like the average Ontarian voter probably doesn't watch the debate. Maybe like a third of people do or something like that. But even among those third, how many people are going to make an effort to watch a debate after it happened, right?
Yeah.
It's unlikely. And this debate, not as bad as that. I mean, it was 6:30 to 8, which is weird, right? Like that seems like it's not a really ideal time for people. Some people are still having dinner at 6:30. That's bedtime for a lot of parents. I know we put our son down at around 7:30 or so on a typical night, 7:30, 8 o'clock. And so all of those things, you have to think like, I don't know how many people got to see the debate. Sometime we don't have polling yet post debate. We'll talk a bit about polling. I don't think there was one out yet, but I mean, sometimes pollsters ask people like, did you watch the debate? Did you read on the debate? Did you watch some or all of the debate? And I wonder if because of the timing, because maybe of pandemic fatigue, all of that, it might not have gotten a lot of viewers, right?
Yeah, I wonder about that for all the reasons you just said. But let's go into it now. So because we did watch every damn second of that, I had it on my second screen as I was working on other stuff, but we did it for you folks. And earnestly, my just general takeaway before we even get into like who won or just anything about that, just the general takeaway of this debate for me was it was a bit excruciating. Like you heard it at the top of the show when Andrew Horvath said, I know you have something better to do on your Monday night than to listen to a debate. Like, I don't think that should be the case. Like, this is actually pretty important. And I know usually these debates, especially federally, do have an impact on your understanding of the leader. So much of voting now is just about how much you like the person. And I really did feel like beyond a few, distinct highlights, it was a little difficult to watch. I don't know if it was the formatting of it. I know a lot of people really liked the moderation we were saying before you recorded, but it did
a lot
just
of people,
feel
yeah.
very stilted. Like, did you get that vibe, Earl? What did you think just generally about the debate?
I mean, it wasn't the worst debate. I think, like, Steve Paikin, you know, from TVO said that he felt all four leaders did well. He said he thinks that in terms of, like, you know, he's never had a provincial debate where all four leaders didn't blow it, per se. Like, yeah. Usually one person has a really awful debate. He said that wasn't the case. And by and large, people seem pretty happy with the moderating. You know, sometimes people chirp about the moderating, whether they were too interrupty, not interrupty enough. You know, and then beyond that, perceptions of partisan bias or animosity. I didn't see much of that. So no. I think people liked the format. A lot of people liked the fact that there was no live audience. Some people are wondering if, you know, as COVID restrictions are loosened and we, you know, quote unquote, return to normal, will we ever have, like, you know, studio debates again? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, you know, people are going to prefer to have, no audience debates that just maybe, you know, change the tone and just it becomes a clapping contest about who can generate the most applause in the room. I think people were by and large happy with the setup. But yeah, I mean, it is hard to watch in some ways because, you know, a lot of issues didn't get addressed nearly enough. And, you know, I think chief among them, there was not nearly enough said about COVID and not nearly enough said about the climate. I can certainly see why people would be frustrated, even if, you know, on a technical aspect, the debate was fine, that the issues weren't fully discussed. And maybe an hour and a half isn't quite enough. I mean, the federal debates, I believe, were usually 2 hours. And I know a province isn't as big as a country, but in many ways, provincial politics, you know, have just the amount of complexity. There still are four leaders on the stage. Maybe given that this is the only, you know, real deal debate, maybe there did need to be more than just an hour and a half to actually get all these stuff in.
Ooh, yeah, that's a big commitment to ask of people, though. Like, to even I would imagine the percentage of people that watch this in its entirety as it was playing live is very, very small. Like, I think it's something you catch for a little bit and then leave. I want to go to our Discord because you're touching on it right there. One of our questions, and again, you want to join our Discord, patreon.com/lefturncanada. This is from arguably Arugula that was asking our take on the concept that it seemed that all four leaders were referring to the pandemic in the past tense. There's a big section where they discussed, you know, the impact of the pandemic, the effect that it had, what we did wrong, what we could do in the future. And I did note that Andrew Horvath did talk about how this is actively still happening. She had a couple of great lines on that. But generally, I would agree that a lot of the leaders and even how it was presented suggested that this pandemic is a past tense sort of thing. I'm wondering if that is just, you know, positioning because, you know, it helps people's brains and hearts if they don't automatically assume that we're still stuck in the bad times, or if it is kind of a unique take now that this is just what our reality is, that it will always be past tense because we don't have the restrictions anymore. What's your take on it?
I mean, I don't know, right? I mean, I think that a lot of people are concerned in some ways because COVID's still real, but I almost wonder if leaders were reluctant to fully go in on it because people are fatigued, right? I don't know. It shouldn't be over. I don't know if it's over, but I do remember, and now look, every poll is potentially different, but last week, I do remember there was a good amount of issue polling, which was like, both, how do you feel the current government is doing on X, but then also how importantly do you see X? And COVID was not at the top. It was not. It was down 4, 5, 6, 7th. Yeah, inflation was higher, economy was higher, environment was higher, education, healthcare were higher. Like, it's a real sense that people have sort of moved on. Now, maybe people are working in COVID into some of those issues. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe if you bring up the fact that, you know, COVID is causing strain on healthcare, that might impact with healthcare, right?
Yeah.
Like, the fact of the matter is people aren't giving it the amount of attention that it would have gotten if this election was May 2021 or even the most recent federal election, you know, last fall, basically, right? Mm-hmm. Where COVID was a major issue, you know, what's been done and, you know, what a new government will or won't do with regard to the pandemic and how, you know, it created this whole big rise for the PPC, you know, basically maybe saving the PPC as a party in some ways. It's not the overarching issue for the median voter. And so Ford did get pushed on it. You know, he sort of softly admitted nothing was, you know, they didn't do a perfect job, but well, I almost feel
right here. Cause it is, yeah, it kind of, yeah, he, the, when Andrew Horvath, and to her credit, yeah, I think she was one of the only leaders at, in that moment in the debate that did try to invoke the reality that Doug Ford made decisions that led to the deaths of thousands of people in the province. Like there's almost one-to-one. We've gone through this so many times in the show. Andrew Horvath, I would have liked her to hit the nail on the head harder, but she did say that, and this is how Ford responded.
Was everything perfect? No, it wasn't perfect, but if there was an issue, I'll get up there. I made the change. I apologize, but
playgrounds,
let's
and police.
Just talk about that
playgrounds
for a minute,
and police.
Mr. Del Duca, for 2.5 years, literally 24/7, I was working on this pandemic. It's easy to sit back from the sidelines when you didn't have to make the tough decisions that I had to make and criticize. You have the easiest job if
Mr.
you just
Ford,
sit there and criticize.
Mr. Ford, respectfully, Mr. Ford, Mr. Ford, respectfully,
sure,
this is
no
the job that you
premier.
Signed up for 4 years
will,
ago.
You, know
you asked for people to support you 4 years ago. You ran to be premier. You must accept responsibility.
Very good. You've both made your points.
So that doesn't seem like someone who's responding to this sort of crisis. It seems like someone kind of shuffling off. I almost got like Biden vibes from Ford a little bit, like just kind of a confused old man in some moments. So anytime he was getting hit by most of the other leaders for the mistakes he was made, I almost was wondering if that was hurting the public perception, because it's like, oh, no, he's just trying his best sort of thing, despite the fact that this is, you know, a kleptocratic lunatic that's done really horrible things for this province. Yeah. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think that it was a good attack, fully valid. Don't think Ford's answer was great, but again, I don't know if people are being fully moved enough by COVID anymore. And this is what we talked about, man. This is what we talked about when we're like, Ford's got to be done, right? Like, you know, when we started this podcast more than a year ago, now we started it during a particular time in COVID. Ford was not doing well, was polling quite poorly, at least in terms of his personal numbers. Ontarians were pissed, and rightfully so. And what we said was, is that one, his polling never really got desperate, right? Like he was never polling in consistently in second place. He wasn't polling in the 20s or anything like that in terms of the horse race. But what we also said was, you know, the timing's gonna matter. Are people going to feel, whether it's accurate or not, that COVID is quote-unquote done in and around election time? Will the economy be moving in roughly the right direction? And if people have a sense that, you know, jobs are coming back, that the COVID is quote-unquote done, that, you know, we're ready to move on, then, yeah, he could certainly survive a second term. And that looks to be what's happening, at least, you know, in the broad consensus of the analysis. And one, we don't have polling from the debate, but one sense I do have, you know, it's like two ways you can answer a question. It's like, who won the debate? You can answer that in the very technical sense of like, who had the best performance over the hour and a half, you know, answering, attacking, defending, all of that. But then also it's like, given that we're only really going to have one debate, like what's the fundamental shift coming out of it? And I think, you know, Ford still has to be the winner there. I don't think he had the best performance. I don't think he was dreadful, necessarily. But you know, fundamentally, Ford was winning going into that debate, likely in majority territory, and he's probably still there. So he won. Like, he won, right?
Simply
like
that's, because, you know, he didn't screw up in the level that he perhaps should have the needle, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. So, yeah, I it's hard to argue with that. I do have to say, though, it was interesting to finally see those opening statements that we showed at the beginning of the show. You really do get a sense of the constituents that are supporting each of these different leaders. I think for a lot of people, this would be the first time you've heard Del Duca in a real professional setting, or really had, you know, an extended little visit with this new Liberal leader. And I think he really gave permission to the, you know, white rich people in our province that this is the guy they can vote for. And he's seen as a real alternative to Ford. Everything that he was talking about is just about, you know, improving things slightly by making slight little cuts and changes, but not making the big drastic cuts that are scary. We right off the bat, we had Horvath talking about workers' rights and the importance of mental health and hitting that hard. And Green Party leader Mike Sherb really did an excellent job, I think, of facilitating his issues with those big ideological bents of helping the environment and that alleviating poverty is really the key to solving so many of these problems, which I do think I agree with. And then we had Ford just kind of fumbling and saying, you know, we'll get more jobs. And wasn't it hard when I was premier? But it was, I think, very interesting to see how distinct each of these leaders were in ways that I didn't expect, because so often in these debates, you know, everyone just kind of mumbles to the middle. There's hardly a distinction between liberal and conservative. And at least listening now, I did think there was, you know, a big difference in ways that I didn't expect. Going into this, we talked about what the NDP needed to do. You know, we're not soothsayers. Who knows what could have been the right thing? Would it have been better if Andrew Horvath went harder on Ford for the criminal evil things he did? As you said before, Krista, there's no guarantee that would help, especially if a lot of people aren't seeing COVID as the real big issue of the day. She had a great slogan for the one policy that I think should be bigger, of saying if you need to go to a therapist, use your OHIP card, not your credit card. And that's huge for so many people. But out of the entire debate, I think I was clocking it, she said it maybe four times. Whereas we had the Green Party leader again talking about his their new housing plan almost every chance that he got. And for me, I really felt like Horvath was not acting like a leader that was kind of scrapping to try to be premier. I don't know if that's just my own interpretation, and maybe I'm expecting something that's just not going to be there, but I didn't feel like there was that fight from this leader that I would want. What's your take on how Horvath did in relation to the other leaders she was up there with?
I mean, I don't think she had an awful debate. I don't.
Yeah.
I think in many ways it was fine. I think she was better on the attack than on the promotion of her policies. And I think that might be the one weakness. Dave Moskrop, who's a writer for The Washington Post, he's a commentator on Canadian politics, said that Horvath did very good on the attack, excellent on it in many ways, but felt she needed to be more specific on some of the plans being given, more detail on the plans. He felt Del Duca was better at giving details. Now, of course, there's a good chance that Del Duca's details are disingenuous. I would say that history makes that extremely likely, given the actions of the Ontario Liberal Party. But they were given, and given confidently and given repetitively. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that, you know, while she didn't have a bad debate, in the sense that, let's operate under the assumption that she's in third and she needs to really make a move to get into second, she probably didn't do it with that debate. Yeah. If that's the case, you would think that at best her and Del Duca were equal, maybe Del Duca slightly better on a technical aspect. I don't think any of the big three-party leaders did good or bad enough in that debate to fundamentally change anything. Like, if we look at the polling, at least in terms of percentage, you know, you have Ford in first, Del Duca in second, Horvath in third, and likely there wasn't much movement to change that. Yeah, you know, Schreiner, I think, clearly won the debate in terms of his performance, both maybe in the sense, because, you know, as the Green Party, there's maybe less expectation, less pressure. But I think, you know, even beyond that, he had the best debate. Certainly, you know, if his seat was in doubt, which I don't think it was, I think it's now rock solid. I think that people in Guelph are almost certainly going to send him back.
Oh, there's Park. More Schreiner signs here than there are like signs for
maybe this
markets,
even gives like... them. Yeah, I mean, maybe this gives him a chance to to even make a move to that Parry Sound Muskoka seat, which it would, I think, normally be maybe be too optimistic. But given that the Liberals don't have a candidate there anymore, it could consolidate some of that vote, that Liberal vote behind him, because and make that Conservative riding green. I still think that's very unlikely, frankly. Because it was still fairly conservative, but it was their second best riding in the last election. Yeah. And so maybe that'll help them. It'll give more people an excuse to vote green in ridings like that. Now, one piece of data that might indicate some success, maybe some good sign for Del Duca, and a lot of people were sharing this last night, and it's not an exact science, of course, is looking at Google search trends, which is something people have done a lot during debates, you know, in the United States, to look at, you know, during the debate, who is trending more. And very clearly throughout much of the debate, Del Duca was the winner in terms of generating interest. Now, some of that likely has to do with people typing, who the hell is Stephen Del Duca? But I don't think it's all that, if we're being honest, right? Like, especially because it's sort of sustained throughout the debate. And he has his biggest spike sort of three quarters of the way through that debate, right? Yeah. And so I think in some ways it's very clear that maybe he was the one that generated the most interest. You know, Horwath and Ford largely stuck together. The Green, you know, Schreiner was often a little bit below them. But, you know, there were a few moments where Del Duca did generate the most search interest, which could be a good sign for him. Again, does that move votes in a meaningful way? I'm not sure. We don't know how many people watched all of that, but my instinct is that whatever position we were in, it's not that different.
Yeah.
It's not that different today. I mean, one thing we can look, there hasn't been, there was one new poll released today, but it's pre-debate, so sort of functionally useless in that sense. But the last aggregate we got, which was from yesterday, again, has the Conservatives well out in front. And what matters, it still seats the Conservatives at 79, the NDP at 23, the Liberals at 21, and the Greens at 1. Yeah. And so despite the fact that the Liberals have more votes than the NDP, averaging probably about 5-6 points more on this particular aggregate, the NDP will still edge them out in seats because the Liberals don't have very good vote efficiency. And the confidence intervals for the Liberals are much higher. They could end up with fewer seats than they currently do, or they could end up with about 50. The NDP are much more in that kind of 11 to 35 range in this with the current stats. But again, as it is right now, if the goal is to win more seats, the NDP are closer to the Conservatives than the Liberals under this current aggregate.
Interesting. So I want to talk a little bit more about Stephen Del Duca, because I really did get a sense that for a certain type of voter that I think you've analyzed this in our previous shows, that will sway not Liberal NDP, but much more likely Liberal Conservative, that this kind of gives them permission to never have to vote NDP again, because now there's a new leader, a new face. He's not saying anything drastic. Most of what I heard was him just kind of trying to do cuts at Ford, obviously, about the big highway build. No one wants this highway. It's hilarious that they're still pushing it, like bringing back grade 13, the bucka ride stuff, like just some very strange small policy plans. And I'm wondering if that chatter that you were talking about during the debate might be more impactful than we might think. You're absolutely right. It is people being like, who the hell is this guy? Yeah. I've never seen him before. I got to actually know who he is. But like that part of the electorate that I believe you were discussing, if not last show, the show before, that kind of ensures that Ford is going to win, because they always just kind of switch back and forth and traditionally haven't gone NDP. Do you think this will push it more? His performance maybe could push that group back to Del Duca, simply because, you know, he didn't fall on his ass and he's not saying anything crazy during the debate.
I'm not sure, right? Yeah. I mean, look, I think what you have seen is, you know, a good chunk of the Liberal voters from 2018 that voted NDP have gone back to the Liberals.
Yeah.
But the Conservatives, not yet. That's what we've seen. A lot of Liberals are really whining hardcore about strategic voting, and I've talked about, so I don't want to belabor the point too much, But let's recall, again, and I've said this, in 2014, the Ontario election, the NDP got about 23, 24% of the vote. And they got 21 seats. The Liberals, conversely, got 39 or so, just under 39% of the vote, and won a majority. They won a majority of the legislature in that election. They just a bare majority, of course, but they won a majority nonetheless, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the if you look at this election polling at this moment, the NDP is polling again, sort of in that low mid 20s. The difference is, however, Ford is in the high 30s and the Liberals are in the low high 20s to low 30s in the best polls for them. And what that really does indicate is that they haven't been able to get back those lost conservative voters. Because remember, I've talked about this. The perception in 2018 was that, there was a big switch from Liberal to NDP. And indeed, there was. The Liberals lost about half their vote. They got 19.5 in 2018 and they lost 19.08. So they literally lost almost half their vote. But half of it went to Ford.
Yeah.
Like the NDP increased their the NDP went up by about 10, the Conservatives went up by about like 8 or 9, right? Like the reality is that the Conservatives got almost as many Liberals switching to them as the other way around, right?
Yeah, I'm wondering if they're... So there's no sense that they're going back from what
At least not yet, right? Yeah. I mean, like, look, we have to see after this debate. We don't know yet. Like, we literally don't know. Like, we're just guessing. But yeah, up until right now is no. Like, Del Duca has, at least according to this polls, been somewhat successful at winning back those voters who went to the NDP in 2018, but not the Conservatives. And that's why the Liberals are back in second ahead of the NDP in most polls, but are still quite a bit behind the Conservatives in pretty much every poll that we've seen. The Conservative vote has largely stayed solid. I know they've lost, you know, a relatively small number to those, like, you know, the True Blue Party or whatever they're called, you know, those two new fringe parties. But by and large, they have not bled back to the Liberals. That's why the Liberals are in second. So in reality, the reason Ford is winning, in a sense, is not NDPers voting NDP, but Liberals voting Conservative.
There we go. All right, so I think I was harping on it a bit before, but I want to keep on it because I get a sense that Andrea Horvath is not being the best messenger for some of these policies that are pretty good that are under the NDP platform. Like it's kind of a shame that, you know, young NDP TikTokers are doing a better job explaining and getting excited about some of these changes that are coming in. Whereas, at least from my perspective, from the debate the other night, I don't even know if it was a strong enough performance on the one big key makeshift issue of the expansion of healthcare, of mental health under this sort of coverage. A great policy that I think if it was enacted today, of course, is not perfect, would inalienably change the rights of Ontarians right away, would help so many people right away. I do you think that this is something that is just the, you know, maybe she's been at this for a while and maybe it doesn't still have that vim and vigor and that fight with it as before? Or is this a planned idea? Do you think this really is, you know, needing to be seen as more reasonable, perhaps more of a moderate, despite the fact that some of their policies are way more progressive than their Liberal counterparts, but maybe it's a plan to try to bring back some of those Liberals that are at least ostensibly putting them into the second place seats? You know, do you think it's just she's tired and it's not working out? There's a bit of a dissonance there. Or is this like maybe even a strategy of we can't be seen as too progressive because lo and behold, those people that switch back and forth will never switch back to us?
I don't know about that. I don't think so, because the platform is pretty progressive for the Ontario NDP.
Yeah.
I think that it is. I think it's a, you know, in many ways it's a bold platform. Mm-hmm. whether or not Horwath sold that well or not is, of course, a matter for debate. But I don't think she was being cautious in the ideological sense. I think a lot of people were underwhelmed by the performance last night. There is seemingly a consensus that she didn't do a sufficient job at really articulating all of the good things in the platform, as you noted.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's based on ideology,
okay,
per se. Because, like, that's silly. Like, if there was a real sense that, you know, she was, you know, going to moderate for ideology, that would have been done in the platform. And I'm sure that was done in the platform. I mean, look, there's a reason why in some ways they had to basically be bullied on the internet into doing the right thing on ODSB.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
and even then, right? It's still, why is it 2 years? Right.
Like, yeah. Is it 2 years? Although, like, if, you know, also, you know, people need to learn to take a win sometimes. I don't, like, who knows, right? Like, it's a big move. It is. Yeah. It shouldn't be 2 years. But, you know, maybe the party wants to have a budget, you know, ready for the next year, and the budget's already kind of been, whatever. It doesn't matter. You're right. Why 2 years? But also, like, if it was just about that, like, that's where you see it. You don't design a platform with all these things in it and do these press conferences where you talk about universal mental health care and then, you know, act calm, like, act, you know, underwhelming in the debate on purpose, right? Yeah. Yeah, certainly not when you're, maybe if you're winning. Like, if she was winning and it's the last debate and she's like, I can't fuck it up, I gotta look more responsible and ready to lead, because, you know, I have all these moderate votes and I need to, like, you know, I need to hold on, maybe that would, like, and I'm not saying that would be the right strategy, but it would be a strategy that you could see someone coming up with. I don't think that was the case. I think that there needed to be a bit more clarity on the policies. But I do think she was good in the attack. And I'm not buying the liberal crocodile tears. A lot of liberals are suggesting right now that Andrea was, you know, too mean and attacking Del Duca, and Del Duca saying, every time you attack me, Doug Ford smiles. When as this is happening, the liberals sent out dozens of tweets basically yesterday alone from the Del Duca account and from the Liberal Party account and some of their MPs and their candidates' accounts basically attacking the Ontario NDP, saying that they're going to make life unaffordable for middle-class Ontarians and their budget is irresponsible. Basically, again, sort of sounding like Doug Ford, at least in their attacks on the NDP. So the Liberals are trying to have it both ways, where, you know, Andrea is being Doug Ford's partner when she attacks Del Duca. Meanwhile, Del Duca is allowed to just go gloves off on her. And of course, he is, of course. They are different parties. He has every right to attack Horwath. I think most of his attacks are disingenuous. Nonetheless, he's allowed to do so. But the Liberals seem to be very, very sensitive about the NDP attacking.
What do they think elections are, really? Like, we're aware of the terms of engagement here. Like, there is a, politics is about the argument of these ideas. And just like you said, Del Duca up there, he, for me, did seem like perhaps the most disingenuous. I will say that Ford seemed almost out of his element and was just bumbling.
Well, Ford's definitely out of it. I mean, like, look, the other leaders, I believe all three wanted to have
no cheat sheets, right?
Yeah, no cheat sheet. Yeah, exactly. No binders, no cheat. I don't know about cheat sheets, but like, no, certainly not like you couldn't have your entire platform in front of you. And I remember in the last election, there was a lot made of the fact that Andrea at most of the debates did not have either notes at all, or certainly not very many. And a lot of people suggested that showed that she was being authentic. She knew her policies. She knew her talking points. It was very well prepared. And I remember that was one of the things that early on in that election sort of gave her credibility. If you remember, like, during those first few debates. In this election, however, it really seems like, you know, Ford just kind of stuck to his platform book, stuck to his notes. And I think that if you're running a, you know, don't fuck up, you know, front runner campaign, maybe that's for the best. But I don't think you got a sense that Ford is, like, all that well versed on the intricacies of the Conservative Party's policies, But and maybe that doesn't matter to his voters, though, right? Like, maybe that doesn't matter to them. Maybe he's like, okay, it matters to a small number of the voters I have, but I can lose a few and still win. My people are going to vote for me no matter what, basically, in this election. And so I'm good to go, right? And, you know, now it's sort of good for him because there are those two fringe parties, but they're not pulling a whole lot of votes in total. And, you know, with COVID, quote unquote, done, there's less of a risk of like a right wing splinter because, you know, there's not really there's functionally no more lockdowns and things like that. Whereas, again, in 2021, Ford would be under much more pressure, not only because the issue of COVID would be so much more cognizant in the minds of people, giving more attack opportunities to the Greens, NDP and Liberals. It would also give him more pressure to kind of either choose between, you know, keeping up lockdowns and mask ordinances and all that, which at the time, at least, were quite popular with most Ontarians, and pissing off his right wing base that would be at least partially willing to go vote for like a third party, which is exactly what happened in the federal election. Like that's what happened. The conservatives weren't even in power federally, but because, you know, O'Toole was not ardently anti, like he was, you know, he at least supported some of the restrictions, at least partially. It gave total credence to Bernier to come out and basically just run as like run an anti-COVID or anti-COVID policy campaign.
And that's not happening
this time, right? Because people are treating it as done. So some conservatives are mad because he booted some people because they didn't get vaccinated. But like, you know, like restaurants don't check for vax slips anymore. They don't do that. Like if you remember,
I just want to say, looking at this debate performance, and again, we will get more concrete numbers possibly in the days to come.
Yeah, usually in the day or two after you're going to get because they have to actually do the polling. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
But even after all that, it seems like for the months that we were talking about the real damage, both physical and like the psychic damage that the Ford administration was doing to people in Ontario, putting people through hell where the military soldiers that were coming in to go into these hell pits had to get PTSD because even just seeing it was so horrifying because of the choices that he was making during this pandemic. He is seemingly able to shrug that all off by fumbling through a sentence saying, you know, we tried our best. It was the hardest time that I've ever faced in my life. It was the hardest that any leader would ever face. And we're going to make sure other leaders don't face that again. And he's seemingly off the hook. And it's hard not to look at that and just think like he's won. Like he has won. The issue of the pandemic here in Ontario and the horrible criminal choices he made, he has won that victory. And it just makes me worried about, you know, what that next pandemic will be and what the outcome will be. If we've seen this is how leaders can bounce back, that he can do almost maybe the worst, I think Kenny probably did worse. I think it's safe to say Kenny did worse, but one like, of the worst things that a premier's ever done during the pandemic here, and he can still probably win the majority and be okay. His base that was affected by this will probably be okay if he says something, you know, half hard felt in the way that I just said. Like it just that's tough. I did not think that would be happening after the years that we had.
Yeah, I mean, well, if you look during this whole crisis, most of the elections worked out pretty good for the incumbents. I mean, the BC election, some people were, upset that the Ontario NDP called that one early, was at least a few months early, the BC NDP, but they went from a minority to a very robust majority that Horgan has not done nearly enough with. Smarten the fuck up, John. Do something, please.
Come on, John.
Yeah, do dental care, please, John, please, if you're listening. If John Horgan listens to this, if anybody who works for the BC NDP, that might actually be the case, tell John to do some dental care, please.
Hey, who knows? Like, we did do a whole episode on ODSP, and then, like, a couple days later...
Look, it's not the thousands of disabled activists and their allies pouring tirelessly over it. It was this podcast and only this podcast that won that. You're welcome, everybody. But in all seriousness, they won the Saskatchewan party. I think they lost a few seats, but they went from a big majority to a slightly less big majority. The federal Liberals won and, you know, basically won a status quo, but they actually picked up. They netted a couple extra seats. You know, the Trudeau Liberals, they and the NDP were the only parties to, like, gain seats. But, you know, it wasn't a big move. But I believe the only incumbent party to lose was the, I believe it was the Nova Scotia, you know, the Nova Scotia Liberals. But I don't think that was based on COVID, right? I don't think that was based on COVID at all. I think that was based on just, you know, on healthcare issues, but specifically the defining moment was actually there was like a big crisis where somebody couldn't get an ambulance and they were only a few minutes away from the hospital and had to wait for like an hour or something, and happened at the right time of the election, and the Liberals had been in power for a little bit, and like all of that sort of together added up to it. But like fundamentally, it was, you know, none of the parties really, really got punished. And so you're right in a sense that, and I was just trying to, because the one I forgot, I think, is the Newfoundland election, the Newfoundland election where the Liberals won in 2019 and then actually expanded their vote a little bit. They won an extra 3 seats and an extra, you know, 5% in the 4% in the legislature. And so, you know, I feel like it's really an example of how, people weren't punished. You know, people weren't punished in any meaningful way. Yeah. I do think that some of that's luck.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of that is luck. That elections seem to happen at moments where COVID was seen as like less intense. The BC election happened at that critical interval where COVID wasn't that big. And, you know, the federal election happened last summer or last fall, just before Omicron, if you remember, right? It was just before it really got insane, right? Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Where, you know, it kind of kicked into overdrive. And so you almost wonder if it's a little bit of luck. But yeah, you're right. It could signal to parties that, you know, it's you know, maybe we could be a bit more lax. Although it might also be the case that most Canadian provinces had at least some measure of pretty strong shutdown, even if they were conservatives, at least for some point. You know, Ontario had a pretty robust shutdown, and compared to the United States, it was quite big. And so maybe the response will be similar, but maybe parties will be quicker to come out of lockdown. I'm not sure. But, you know, every pandemic is different, right? Yeah. Every pandemic is different. But I do think, unfortunately, that this was something that we had not dealt with since like since the Spanish flu, right? Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? This is the first real pandemic we've had in at least in Canada. I can't speak for the world. Like in modern Canadian history.
Yeah, people would rather have things go back to normal and get that sense than like actually change things so that it won't happen again, right? Or so there's a reckoning. We desperately want, and I understand, like, of course, but these are the perpetrators that have made this thing even worse, that have made it absolutely a terrible time for everyone in places where it wouldn't have been. The cuts before, the cuts during, and it's just, you know, he's gonna get away with it, and other people have and will again in the future. I don't know why I'm surprised by it, but it just, you're absolutely right. If it's not a big issue for people anymore, and it's not even necessarily like you blame them, because every other issue that was talked about in that debate in many ways is an existential crisis, whether it is the climate, whether it is housing, whether it is healthcare, like all of these things could destroy your lives if we don't get big changes. It's hard to have all of that and also the effects of the pandemic that, at least ostensibly, are not around you as intensely anymore. We got other stuff that is killing us just as actively as it was beforehand, but it's still just deeply upsetting. I'm looking at the time here. I wanted to get some just kind of closing thoughts and some summary ideas of this sort of debate. I think you said it before, but just to headline it, if you had to pick a winner and you can decide the criteria for the winner, who do you think would be the winner of the only Ontario election debate? Not the only, the last, excuse me, Ontario election debate.
I think it was the debate itself, probably Schreiner.
Yeah.
But in terms of the result, it was Ford. Yeah. I don't think, like, maybe again, maybe some people are like, oh, Del Duca did better than Horwath, and that might accelerate ABC movement. Who knows? Blah blah blah. Although on the other hand, maybe all of that, maybe that's already started to happen. Maybe the ABC movement's already started to happen. We don't know. As of right now, from my perspective, nothing that happened last night shook Ford in his position winning. And I'm quite confident even in his position of majority right now. Mm-hmm. And so Ford was the winner. As sickening as that is, he won in the sense that, you know, he was going into that debate as a incumbent premier in majority territory, and that's how he exits. Schreiner had the best night on the debate, but it's, you know, what does that functionally mean? Maybe that'll pay dividends for the Greens in coming elections, but I sort of think that whether he had a bad night or whether he had a good night, he likely remains the only Green MP or MPP, yeah. Right? Like, I think, yeah. I don't even think a bad performance last night would have shook him in Guelph. He's seen as a good local MPP. He would have won his seat. He could have given the best debate in history, likely would have been stuck with one seat. And so that's the two functionalities. I would say that Del Duca likely had a better night than Horwath, but I don't think the margins are as large as some people were suggesting. I think that Del Duca, in the sense, was able to introduce himself, and that likely gave him a little bit of a bump.
I do wonder about that. So that's my perspective on it. I agree completely about Schreiner. He did, I think, a very great job, especially, like, I almost wish that Andrea Horvath was saying the same sort of things. When he kept relaying these horrible issues that we're facing to the need to alleviate poverty as one of the, you know, chief concerns of Ontarians in 2022, I thought that was excellent. And I couldn't believe that we're actually getting policy that's, you know, economically perhaps so clear. But I think that maybe that Del Duca bump, even just, you know, people now aware of him and that he isn't a fool, seemingly, may have impact in ways that we haven't yet seen. I do wonder about that. The final question I got for you today, Christo, is this idea of outcomes, because we've been dancing around it. We don't always do forecasting of what we hope will happen in this election. Currently, as you said, it seems like Ford went in there likely to re-secure his majority and will leave in that same state. You know, on election day, with what you're seeing right now, do you think what could be an outcome that would lead to a Ford no longer being premier? If you needed to think of one outcome that would, what do you think is the likeliest outcome that would lead to him not being premier? And if you got any ideas even of how that would look, even the minutia of it would be interesting. But yeah, what is the one situation where that would maybe happen?
I do think that it would likely, like, I mean, I guess hypothetically you could see a collapse of either the Liberal or the NDP vote, but I don't know how much more there is. I think one thing would be the NDP currently in the numbers staying largely where they are, but a last minute move from the Liberals to the from the Conservatives to the Liberals might take Ford's majority. I would be quite shocked if he doesn't end up winning the plurality of seats.
Yeah.
Is something. One, he's got a big lead. And two, looking at the vote efficiency Ford seems to have right now, is that even if there's a situation, I think he might have a Trudeau-like scenario where for whatever reason, his vote efficiency is really good. And so even if Del Duca was able to get, you know, say 34 and Ford was to be at 33, I think Ford still wins more seats. But I think the most likely outcome to have Ford removed right now would be to see him removed in a minority situation, like a hypothetical situation where he's short, and the Liberals and NDP and maybe even Schreiner would join as well. Who knows? Would depend on the math and all of that. Would remove him through some kind of supply and confidence deal. I don't think you'd see a formal coalition, because right now I don't see him coming out second in seats. Like I don't, like, again, yeah. That debate, like maybe a big scandal happens. Maybe there's like a new mega COVID wave and like Ford gets blamed for it. Like, I don't know. Right. Like, but right now there's no indication I have that he is going to lose enough seats to finish second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
man. So the only chance then, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, of that possibly happening, what you're seeing now, and anything is possible, is if Del Duca and the Liberals are in that second spot to provide some kind of, you know, coalition or something like that to unseat. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, one thing we've said before, and I'm sort of skeptical about this, I'm skeptical of the idea that Del Duca and I'm sort of skeptical that Del Duca would make Horwath premier.
Yeah.
Right? I'm sort of skeptical of that. I think that in some ways, that Del Duca does not want Horwath to become premier. The Liberals understand, as they did in 2018, that the existential to the existence of their party is the Ontario NDP winning. It's not a guaranteed death blow, because as we recall, the Ontario NDP won in 1990 and the Liberal Party did not disappear. You know, but, you know, there was another conservative regime in between them and the NDP, but they came back and, of course, governed for a good long time under McGuinty and Wynne and all of that, right? And then are out and maybe back in soon. There is a sense, I think, that if Horwath was to become premier and they were to lose to the NDP two times in a row, which is something that hasn't happened, right? Because even in the Liberals' law in 1990, of course, the Ontario NDP won the election, right? But, you know, by 1995, the Ontario NDP fell back to third, right? Mm-hmm. And the Liberals became the opposition again. So while they did not win, fundamentally, they were clearly back in the top two. Like, the order was restored in that sense. Yeah. They never finished, to my knowledge, I don't know if they've ever finished second to the NDP twice in a row, right? In that sense. I mean, I know there were some elections where I think maybe the NDP finished second. I know that in 1975, looking at this year, the NDP finished second in seats ahead of the Liberals, but behind them in popular vote. You know, there were these occasional moments in 1950. One, I believe, one of these, yeah, in 19, and of course, going back to the CCF, there were some days where the Ontario CCF finished ahead of the Liberals, but fundamentally, that's a threat to them. I think in that scenario, I don't know if Del Duca would make a deal. I don't know. I don't think Del Duca is going to make a deal to prop up Ford. Like, for instance, if the Ontario NDP came first in seats, I don't think Del Duca is going to make a deal with Ford to keep him out. Like, I don't suspect that would be the action. I think the most likely scenario, though, is in a minority would be something where the NDP finished second, is Ford wins, the NDP second, the Liberals are third. The Liberals hypothetically have enough seats to make Horwath premier and extract some concessions to get things they want from their policy book, blah, 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 but choose not to do that and just let Ford govern on a bill-by-bill basis, wow, if that makes any sense, and just sit it out. Horwath, conversely, one, because I think the NDP is more genuine and their desire to defeat Ford would be less likely to do that and would actually make a deal. And even though they're currently second, the party has more of a historical relationship with not being one of the two big parties. So I think that's the most likely option, is Ford finishes second or Ford is in a minority position with the possibility of the other parties adding up to more than the majority.
So we will see what's happening, folks. Thank you so much for joining us as we look at the debates. Let's see the dates on this one. Yeah, so we'll have a couple more shows until the election comes out. We're going to be talking about this and expanding, talking about other things. If you want to join our little community, please do. patreon.com/lefturncanada. Got a lot of folks on Discord there. Always have interesting stories about what it's like for different Canadians here. And of course, at Left Turn Canada on Twitter. We're growing that community there too. So thank you very much, and we will see you next week.